How many of you have been in a previous session? Any of you? One, two, three. One of these on religion and experience. How many of you have been in? All right. I hope that you won't mind if I take just a little bit of time to clue people who are just here for today into what it is that we are trying to do. And I would like those of you who have been here before then, before this, to feel a particular concern to raise clarifying questions or to raise questions that say, as I've been thinking about this, I don't quite see it the way you do. Okay? What we have been trying to do is to understand the categories, that is, the concepts and the patterns, not just concepts in our mind, but the pattern, the concepts of our thinking and the patterns of our experience, which determine our religious experience. Now, we have been concerned to do that because we've been making some assumptions. The basic assumption is that we experience God differently than we experience other people. We've been trying to describe that by saying we have direct experience of one another in a way that we do not have direct experience of God. For that reason, the language that we use when we are speaking in religion or when we are discussing theology is language which uses comparisons. We call those comparisons analogies. We say, God is like this, or God is not like this. Or we say, my relationship to God is like this, or my relationship to God is not like this. Right? There are positive and negative analogies. And what we have been trying to do in these sessions is to explore those analogies. Now, those analogies are very important because they are the only way in which we can make our own religious experience available to us. Whether we conceptualize our religious experience or not, even the patterns of our religious experience are patterns, we are saying, that are analogous to or comparable to other very, very basic patterns of human experience. So even, first of all, in understanding, becoming aware of my own religious experience, I need to become aware of the experiential analogies within which I experience myself religiously, or in the way, or within which I think about my own religious experience. Let me give you an example of that. The example of this is when we speak of God as Father. We pray the Lord's Prayer. We say, Our Father, who art in heaven. Now, Father is a very, very meaningful term. It would take us a long time to discuss all of the meanings of that word and all of the associations which it evokes. So speaking of God as Father is a very, very powerful theological expression. experiencing God as Father is a very, very powerful form of religious experience. Now, however, as we saw last week, and I'm not going to try to repeat that, but simply report to you on the work, some of the work that we did. As we sat in a group like this and said, well, what comes to mind when you think of God as Father? And what are the patterns of your own experience which form and shape your relationship to God as Father? We had quite a varied pattern of response. Some people shared their responses with us, shared with us their experiences of fathers, of the fathers with whom they grew up, shared their experience of being fathers. And it immediately became apparent that each person who shared with us had a distinct set of experiences of their own father or of their own fatherhood. And that their thinking about God as Father and their experience of God as Father were very, very intimately related to those individual personal experiences. As we talked about some of those experiences, we spelled out some of the analogies. And people found themselves saying, well, yes, in some ways, God is like my father. And in some ways, I certainly hope and trust that God is not like my father was. And some of us who are fathers had to say the same thing, saying, well, I think in some ways I am toward my children as God is. But I'm also aware that in some ways I have been an ungodly father. So the first thing that has happened is that we have, in these discussions, become aware of our own level of experience. And that has had the effect for people in last week, with people with whom I've talked, sometimes in the session, sometimes after the session, of clarifying, at first, thinking about God. Clarifying things at a conceptual level. But there has then, if as we've gone along, for some persons, also been a reworking at the experiential level. That there has been an understanding that some feelings about God are related to very, very basic experiences in human life. Since the theme of this summer is lighten our darkness, I would relate what we are doing to that theme by saying that in that respect, by gaining insight into ourselves, into our own relationship to God, and into the pattern and substance of our own religious experience, that we are lightening internal darkness. We are shedding some light in dark places within ourselves. And that we have learned we don't have to be afraid of doing that. Now, that kind of clarification about what is going on within myself also makes it possible for me to communicate with other people in a different way when I speak about religion or theology or when we are discussing. Because as I become aware that the language which I use and the patterns of my experience are formed and shaped by very personal, individual patterns of experience, I also begin to understand that the language which you use and your religious experiences are also shaped by such individual and unique patterns. And that, so if it may seem that we are contradictory to each other, you may say, God is like Father, meaning my Father. And what you hear me saying is, God is not like Father, meaning my Father. We may both be saying the same thing, because we've had different fathers. But if we don't take that into account, you may say to me, don't say that about Father, meaning my Father. And so you can see too why, since theological conversations and religious conversations always touch on such very, very deep and basic levels of religious experience, you can perhaps can understand why arguments about religion and theology are sharper and more bitter and more hateful and mean than almost any other kinds of arguments are. But if we have the chance to experience that in these two sessions this week, we may also have the opportunity to experience that we can come to understand one another better by listening to the patterns of experience out of which we speak, which form and shape our language about God, and which also become the patterns for our religious experience. So that things which are important for you may not be so important for me. And things which are important for me may not be so important for you. And may even be symbolized in contradictory ways. Now, how do we do this? Well, what we have done last week is to take a very, very basic kind of human experience and reflected on it, and those in the group who were willing and felt something that they wanted to share and felt comfortable about sharing, shared that. But you're not under any obligation to do that. We're not dependent upon that. But it is an opportunity for any of you who would like to do that to examine elements of your own personal experience that have shaped and determined your religious experience and your relationship to God. And examine, and by examining them, to ask, well, is that valid? Or is that not valid? Is God like my Father? Or is God not like my Father? And if the answer to either question is yes, of course the next question is how? Okay. Last week we looked at three basic elements of personal life. We looked at trust, autonomy, willpower, and we looked at purposeful living. And those discussions are on tape. I'm not going to try to recapitulate them here. Our theme for this week is promise, law, and gospel. And those three themes parallel the three themes of last week, but from a different perspective. I'd like to think with you a little bit about the word promise. I'd like you just to stop for a moment and ask yourself, how do I feel about the word promise? What kinds of feelings does it evoke in me? Hang on to that. Hang on to that feeling, whatever it is. Okay? I'd like to give you some common sayings from our culture. Promises. Promise her anything, but give her. Just, you could substitute, you know, anything there, whatever you're trying to sell. Or promise him anything, but give him. And I wonder now if you'll hold on to that feeling and recognize that it is at least possible in our culture for people to have some negative feelings about promises. Be aware that promises are not automatically trusted. There's a part of the country that I come from in the Southeast, there's a country music song that goes, "What did I promise her last night?" Some negative feelings about promises. We all have learned something about distrusting promises. Interestingly enough, there's not that same kind of cultural expectation about trusting promises. I've been trying to find some parallels to the examples that I have cited in which there are common reflections of trustfulness in promises. If any of them come to mind, I would really appreciate your sharing them with me, either here or later. But I have not been able to find.
I understand the question, Zach. Are you saying, have we ever had a situation where a promise was trustworthy?
Where a promise was not fulfilled, yeah.
Or where a promise wasn't trustworthy.
What wasn't, or I am sure that people have made promises to you and have fulfilled them. But there is in the way in which the word promise is used in our culture, there's a kind of sense that promises will not be fulfilled.
Oh yeah, virtually any promise by a politician in a campaign is suspect.
Okay. Now, is there anything in our language or in our culture, is there any common saying or common reflection in which expresses a trustfulness in the promise? Expresses that the promise will be fulfilled.
When you promise your children things, you have to keep them. Like, you promise me, you have to keep it.
I don't, though. I don't. That's my feeling about promise. I mean, I feel guilty when I think of promise because I've broken promises like crazy. Even trying. Yeah. I mean, I think I try. I've broken bunches.
The one thing I can think of is the adage about a handshake is as good as a contract. That's a form of promise.
Yes. All right. Now, I have made a contract with a handshake once in my life for several thousand dollars. And the man with whom I made it has kept the contract. But I suspect that many of you would also say that to hand over several thousand dollars to someone on the basis of a handshake.
You're crazy.
Huh? Yeah?
Not very good. With friends, you can do that.
You can.
Okay. I don't know.
You sometimes risk the friendship.
Yeah, that's a good way of running a friendship. Fix it so you won't talk to your family for the rest of your life or something like
that. Yes.
Just came to mind that promises have enough lot to do with whatever my expectations are, what the other person's expectations are. And those kind of have to be ferreted out and really dug into. I'm thinking about I as a clergyman over against a congregation that would give me a letter of call. I have expectations. It's got to be better there than it was the last place. And maybe I have the expectations, you know, this guy's got to be better than the guy we just railroaded out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These kinds of things. And there's, at least in that area, there's got to be some cleaning up of the act on both sides. It's a long time for some of us to learn, and we don't learn.
Mm-hmm. So some of the experiences that come to mind as we think about promises are the sense of really wanting to keep promises, the sense that it's not always easy to keep promises, the sense that it may not be entirely rational to trust a promise too far, the sense that when people make promises, there are expectations on both sides, conditions under which the promise is to be fulfilled or not fulfilled, and
it changes so quickly too. You know, whatever circumstances may not be the same. You know, same parameters are not there. When you made that, you may have it all figured out, like a marriage, for instance,
mm-hmm.
or contract with the boss, or whatever. And you know, all of a sudden, some little thing can come in that throws the whole thing off, and you have to renegotiate the contract, make new promises.
Mm-hmm.
And that business of the new promises kind of wear me out.
Okay.
And I see a lot of people are that way too, that they just want to go through the hard work of renegotiating those contracts, those promises.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hang on to that. I'd like to come back to some of that when we come and talk about law. Yeah.
Very interesting. Phil and I were just talking yesterday on the retreat in response to a question that he had asked me. I talked, I didn't call it this under the tree, but I want to call it this now, sanctity of intent. In other words, it's not so much the fulfillment of the promise that I concern myself with, but it's the intention of the individual making the promise. It takes into consideration, first of all, the finiteness of our existence. It acknowledges the presence of variables that we often overlook. And it also just simply is an indicator of how circumstances and situations might radically alter human behavior. And the final analysis, though, is the intentions that can't be judged. And you see, unless, of course, one has an awful lot of data about past performances of individuals who have entered into these mm-hmm. promissory situations with persons before. Now, Bob, I guess when one talks about promise in relationship to marriage, that I have a little problem with, because I have not differentiated in my own mind the difference between a promise which may not carry any kind of legal, moral, ethical overtones, and say a vow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, maybe we'll have a chance to do that. I want to take the opportunity to introduce to you a faculty member who arrived Saturday. You arrived. I don't know if you've been introduced to the group yet or not. This is Will Hertzfeldt, who will be here for the next 2 weeks, and from Oakland, California. And you'll be doing some things beginning tomorrow morning, if I remember the schedule correctly.
Thanks for the commercial.
Well, that's all right. For the others of you who are new, the gentleman sitting by the other pillar with the beard, the very learned, wise, sagacious gentleman, is Phil Schrader, who is a village philosopher and the person to whom to go if you have any desires about the program or complaints or dissatisfactions or feel that the promises that were made to you are not being kept. And to
make no promises. You're too wise.
Okay. And to the left, who is left, is Judy Theiss.
Theiss.
Yeah. Theiss. And you're doing death and
I'm doing some music here. I'm going to do something for funeral music this week.
Oh, okay. All
right. And women's concerts.
All right.
I don't know why those two fit together.
Okay. Well, I want to come back now to what you were saying, Will, for just a moment. Because I'd like to pick up that whole element of intention in promise, which, and that the person making a promise is, I don't know your name, but
Luther,
as Luther also pointed out, that we make promises without knowing the conditions under which they're going to be fulfilled, and that seems to in some way to say to us, well, that changes the promise, and there are a lot of promises which we all understand are going to be changed for that. Yes.
That idea of intent, I just thought of a comic strip I saw years ago that I thought it illustrated. It was one of these ones about a man and wife, and the scene was early morning, and they were in bed, and the window was wide open. And he says to his wife, "I'll give you a mink coat if you'll get up and close the window." And she says, "No deal." He says, "I'll give you $500," and she says, "No deal." He says, "I'll give you 50 cents cash." And she says, "Sold." And she knew the intent of those.
Oh, my. Okay. I'd like to ask you now to go back and think about what I want to describe as the primal promise in our experience. And by primal promise, I mean the first experience of promise, which tends to shape all of our other experiences of promise. I like to think back to the time before you were born. To the time when the family into which you were going to be born first became aware that a child was on the way. Of course, perhaps even began to think that they wanted a child to be on the way. One way of thinking about promise and all of the varied dimensions of promise is to think about that experience and to consider that a family that brings a child into the world makes certain promises. I don't know what they are. But there is a kind of commitment on the part of the family to an unknown child. Nobody really, really knows. And that all of us have had that experience of promise before our coming in to the world. The promise antedates my own existence. Think about that. Think about, if you can, if you're willing for just a moment to think about that as possibly being promise. Think about the different ways in which families approach the birth of children. Different ways in which children are received into families. Some families say, we want a girl. Have been times in the not too far distant past, in at the time of the New Testament, when if you said we wanted a girl and you got a boy. As a matter of fact, we have a first century letter from a businessman, a Greek businessman, who's traveling, and he writes his wife, and among other things, he has this very brief period, a paragraph, I hope everything's going well with the pregnancy, and if it's a boy, keep it. If it's a girl, throw it out. Already a promise that says, this promise will be kept under certain conditions. Promises are sometimes made in hopes that the person to whom the promise is made will really be someone special. If I had known. But if you can think now of the kind of promise which you would like a family to make if you were being born into it. Okay. What would you like to characterize? Kinds of things would be important. Yes.
I think we haven't talked about trust here. It seems to me that there's a difference. Probably there's different kinds of promises, but usually promises are thought of as good. And if they are good, then there's a trust where there maybe isn't any direct promise made.
Okay. It is important that we think about trust in relationship to promises, because one of the ways that all of us learn to trust is by experiencing the promise that was made to us being kept. As people keep their promises to us, we learn to trust.
What about the baby, though, that hasn't been born? Doesn't
a baby have a trust before they receive any promise? A baby certainly learns to learn to trust before it knows, before it can think about the promise. Whatever this promise of the family is to the baby, it is a it. The keeping of it or not keeping of it is experienced by the baby. And in that experience, we have all learned to trust. Whereas we learn to trust before we learn to think. As our patterns of trust and mistrust as infants are shaped before we are able to think about the difficulties of making promises and the ambiguities and the complexities of the conditions, all of which we have talked about. There is a very, very simple, very direct relationship. And I realize that I have made some assumptions in identifying the reception of a child by a family as the primal experience of promise. I think, however, that if we can share with one another some of the basic dimensions of that experience, we will begin to see very strong parallels to promises that we are very consciously aware of. And that will validate my hypothesis that this is the primal experience of promise, whether it is kept or not. So if it's for at the moment, it's not essential whether we think of the way in which the family receives the child as promise or not. I think that we can come back to that later. It might be more useful for me to put the question that I'd like you to reflect on, and if you feel comfortable in sharing, otherwise I will share simply out of my own experience, to reflect on what would you like to characterize the way in which a family receives a child.
I'd like that child to be wanted.
To be wanted.
Wanted.
Okay. It's important to be a wanted child.
Okay. Can I just share something here?
Sure.
I don't know if this will mean anything to anybody, but our family, I think, was my mother and father were kind of private people, and we never did a lot of sharing and things like that. But I can remember one of the first jobs I had, I first became aware of this when fellows were, they were expecting children in their families, and they were so hoping it would be a boy, you know, and you could see the disappointment when it was a girl and the joy when it was a boy. And I am the second oldest of the living children of a family of four girls, and I never thought anything about this until I saw the reaction of these men in the office. And I thought, well, I wonder what my parents thought when this all happened. And I went back a little bit and began to think about it. This was the time when Eddie Cantor had five girls, and all these jokes were made about his five. And that child lived less than a week and died. And my mother was very ill for a long time after that. And then about every 2-3 years after that, these four girls were born. And I often thought, I wonder what my father said, you know, what he did, what happened at his job, how did he receive this? And you know, I searched way back, and I never, ever heard my father ever say anything about being disappointed in a girl. And I know how happy they were that everybody was well, mm-hmm. and that my mother was well. And I thought, well, you know, that was really wonderful, you know, to think that we were all welcomed and we were all, even though we were girls, and I know a couple of times when we were at picnics or different things, people would kid him about all his women and his girls, and my father never, he said, aren't they great, or something like that, you know. I never ever heard him say anything about not having a boy, and I really think that was great. I think he, maybe in my mother and father, in their own private way, made some promises to each other that whatever God gave them, what they had, 10 fingers and 10 feet, 10 toes and 2 eyes and ears to hear, and I think they were grateful.
So it was it was important for you to be wanted as what you were, as a healthy girl, as a girl baby who was healthy. And it's I just would like to emphasize that on the one hand there's the experience of being a girl and wanting to be wanted for that. Since you were healthy, you could also understand that parents would want a healthy child. Yes, there was a lady.
Well, I was thinking that what we really want is an unconditional promise, what we hope for, because there are not conditions attached to the promise that I must be healthy.
Mm-hmm. An absolutely unconditional promise?
Well, this is ideal. This is what God gives me.
Mm-hmm.
I realize this is a great deal to ask of human beings, but it, to me it's really hope to carry out.
But it's we'd like to be, even if we turn out to be an unhealthy boy,
fill the child with his love and care. Not be set outside to die.
Mm-hmm.
Or even die emotionally because of what's missing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, Phil?
That comment and the comment of the lady who was regretting all the promises that she has not kept have caused me to reflect on my own parents and to want to say that in spite of whatever promises they may not have kept to me, they always kept the big one. They were always there for me. And that kind of promise, they weren't always there in the way I wanted. There were times when I didn't feel they were there, but from this retrospective perspective, you know, I can see. And I can contrast that with some children and some families, you know, some children who couldn't say that. So that it's not just, it's not something that anybody can say, but it's an expression of deep gratitude on my part when I say it. Some parents are not there. They do put them outside the house or let go and forget, that sort of thing. But that helps me to relativize the promises that weren't kept. And it helps me, I hope not to rationalize, but also to see in better perspective the promises that I don't keep to my children. There is one promise that I'm bound and determined to keep, and I think I'm keeping all the time. I'm there for them, and I'm determined to be there, and that for me, at least right now, feels very much like an unconditional kind of promise. I'm really determined to be there for them, even though I will promise them an ice cream cone and not buy them one. But those are little things, you see. Those are little promises over against the very big one. And I want to say about my own parents, they really kept that big promise. They were there.
A word came to mind when we were talking about unconditional, maybe that the child be accepted under whatever conditions it arise in.
More than accepted, loved. Believe. Is it the same word?
Well, I think that would be next, because I feel in our experience we have adopted a child, and there are a lot of steps, I think, that we went through. It's a very difficult thing.
You had in adopting a child, one does not have.
Well, we have natural born children and adopted too, right. And the adopted, every one of our children, I think, has brought with it its own problems as well as its own joys and wonders. But our adopted child, I think, backed us into the corner. I must speak for myself. Don can tell you his story about it. Because this child was ill.
Mm-hmm.
For a year, in such a way that I couldn't sleep more than about 3 or 4 hours every night for a year. You know, that sort of thing backs you up pretty tight.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to start step by step. We had to intellectualize. What are the steps of parenthood? What do you do? Well, we kind of walked the path, you know, mechanically, and then hoped that the rest of the steps would come. So we felt acceptance was number one, and love grows then, but that was number one. And anyway, that's why I think acceptance under any condition is important.
Yes.
Well, it seems to me that bringing a child into the world is such a responsibility that it seems important that before they're born that they be dedicated to God, especially when you think of what the situation is in the world now, that the overpopulation and all. If you're going to bring a child into the world, hopefully he or she will be of use by God to make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
Well, death is, to me, it's a very scary field when you can determine ahead of time whether your child is going to be deformed and things, and you make the decision, are we going ahead and let this child be born or not?
Yeah, I mean,
this really is disturbing. I haven't done a lot of, you know, study or insight on it, but I work in this field of obstetrics, and it really bothers me.
Mm-hmm. That's a big responsibility.
Mm-hmm. It's some parents are faced with the difficult decision as to whether to terminate a pregnancy because of a high probability that the child will have serious difficulties. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yes?
You're taking this from the point that you know the child is on the way. Is there maybe not a promise at the point of conception?
Well, go ahead.
Well, what I'm saying is, at every possible time of conception, maybe there should be a promise.
Mm-hmm.
that if that child is actually conceived, then that's where you're thinking ought to begin.
Mm-hmm. I think I would certainly agree with you. I just didn't want to say it for you, because I couldn't know until you said it what you meant. I think too that you see that one of the things which I would like to, which I as a child would like to be promised before I am born, are parents who love each other. And that's really tremendously important for a child. And so I would like to be conceived in love. Or at least, if that is not always the case, to be loved when conceived. Yes.
How does that work in societies like Japan, where they have arranged marriages and they don't talk about a love relationship? You know, not traditionally, and yet the promises in society and trust and all those things about parenting, I've seen do a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm. Because there are
in comparison to the other, where they're going through a lot of cultural change on the matter of so-called love marriages, or you know, going out on their own to find their mate, and the ones that were picture marriages, or the matter of, you know, parents getting in, you know, making the deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps it's because our love marriages are marriages that are determined by romantic love, mm-hmm. which I think at least some of us have experienced to be different than the kind of love relationship that is necessary for the ongoing functioning of a marriage. That romantic love must also be transformed. Mm-hmm. I think the question as to whether it is the best basis on which people can make a choice of the marriage partner is a very important question. But it's one that I'd like to kind of bypass right now. Okay? But I think that the people who enter into relationships, for example, into arranged marriages, the important thing would be then the mutual acceptance of that relationship and the willingness to function in it and carry it out. Yes?
Going back to what you said about the relationship between husband and wife and how important that is to the child, we do have, hopefully, that love and commitment from the father or the mother to the child. But hopefully there's that deep commitment and trust between mother and father. And I think of a little phrase that I have in front of me in my office. The most important thing a father can do for his children is to love their mother.
Mm, yes.
Okay. Kind of a triangle of love and acceptance and trust.
But the kids are jealous. I can go, oh, Allison was terrible when she was a little tot. Every time Don came home, she was in between us, screaming, just kind of vivid example. So that loving mother is grand if men both can turn and say, come join the circle, or make a circle or something.
Yeah, but it probably would have been different if she would have known that I didn't love
him. I don't know what she'd do.
Theoretically, that triangle is one of strength. The triangle is representative of strength. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to draw attention here to a parallel between what we have been talking about and the doctrine of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. The relationships between Father, Son, and Spirit are almost as mysterious on Trinity Sunday as the relationships between father and mother are to a young child. And yet the child senses the quality and nature of those relationships, and it's very, very important. And if you'll contrast the doctrine of the Christian doctrine of the Trinity with polytheistic religion, for example, those of you who know something about Greek or Latin mythology, in which the gods are in conflict with one another. And the paradigm of the family there is the conflicted family, in which Jupiter is on your side and Juno, his wife, is against you. And what happens to you when you get caught in that? We just have a few minutes left. I think we're coming pretty close to coffee break. Probably 3 minutes, Phil, is that a... Do we have three?
It's when the bell rings.
Okay.
It doesn't ring at any set time.
All right. You are a philosopher. I'd like to just talk a little bit about this whole matter of the unconditional promise and the tension between we as parents giving an unconditional promise to the child that we are about to receive and the fact that we as parents also have some wants. I appreciated what you were saying because I heard in it your understanding both that your father might have wanted a boy someplace and along the line, especially since your older brother had died. And that is understandable, but yet that what he wanted did not result in a rejection of you. And that was very important. And the problem would arise not with the wanting, but with the rejecting. I'd like to just think for a moment about ask you to reflect for a moment on the difference between what God wants in the people whom he creates and what he's got. Okay. And how, I'd like to come back to this on Wednesday then, how would we want God? What is our hope about the way in which God reacts to that situation? The second point which I would like to make is that there was a conversation here about being loved and being accepted, and whether we love first and then accept, or whether we accept first and then love. And we saw that in parental relationships and in human relationships, including the difference between romantic marriage and arranged marriage, there can be some difference in that particular sequence. But that the question of that we sometimes as parents experience that we are not able to accept or to love. the child that comes to us. That parents sometimes do experience that. And that children sometimes experience that. Not sometimes totally, sometimes partially. And that one of the things that we would, I think, want God to be for us is able to love and to accept us whatever shape we are in. And that the paradigm of that is the experience that all of us have as children. That we are in some ways not always what our parents want us to be. That experience may come with the discovery that we have 11 toes. It may come later in life, but I wonder if you've ever had as children the experience of disappointing your parents and knowing that you had disappointed them, and how they responded and how it was important for them to respond. When we do that, I think we will begin to come into the distinction between conditional promises and unconditional promises, which is described in Lutheran theology in the terms law and gospel. One of the emphases that I would like to focus on Wednesday, and that is that the gospel is an unconditional promise, not to that which is unknown and might disappoint, but to the person who is known to have disappointed. And that is a difference in focus in the term promise and gospel. Appreciate your being here, your willingness to share. Look forward to picking this up with those of you who are left with us yet on Wednesday. The rest of you have a good trip.